Hello, my name is Al, and welcome to our reading of The Nation for Tuesday, February 17th. It was published February 2026. In 2018, they called themselves the Badasses, a cadre of female national security and military veterans running for Congress as Democrats. In what turned out to be a wave of anti-Donald Trump victories, and a landslide for women candidates. All five, Michigan's Elisa Slotkin and Virginia's Abigail Spanberger, both ex-CIA officers, New Jersey's Mickey Sherrill and Virginia's Elaine Loria, both ex-Navy officers, and Pennsylvania's Chrissy Houlihan, an Air Force veteran, won their contest in purple districts that year. They emerged as an effective force of center-leaning liberals that challenged Trump and then helping President Joe Biden enact his social welfare and infrastructure agenda. In 2024, Slotkin was elected to the Senate, and in 2025, Spanberger and Sherrill won landslide victories to become the governors of their respective states. Only Loria lost her seat in 2022. She's running again this year and has a good chance to take it back. In 2026, their counterparts are the Hellcats, four female Democratic military veterans seeking to follow the Badasses' battle plan to win congressional seats in purple districts. They're Arizona's Joanne Mendoza, a retired Marine challenging Representatives Juan Chicamani, New Jersey's Rebecca Bennett, a Navy pilot officer, taking on Representative Thomas Keene, and Mara Sullivan, a New Hampshire Marine looking to replace Representative Chris Pappas, who's running for an open Senate seat. There's also Kate Conley, a West Point graduate, former National Security Council official, and Army veteran with six tours overseas and the Bronze Stars, three of them, who is up against New York Hudson Valley Representative Mike Lawler in one of only three districts won by Kamala Harris in 2024 that is still held by a Republican. They could be key to the Democratic Party assuming control of the House in 2027, since it will need just three seats to flip that chamber. The Hellcats are running in the wake of the landmark wins by Slotkin, Spanberger, and Sherrill in the past 2 years, and they're getting national attention. They began a signal chat with another in mid-2025 and branded themselves as Hellcats after a World War I cohort of female Marines who were confined to desk duty but nevertheless won the uniform and made the same salary as male Marines. "I was a junior in high school on 9/11," Conley says. With her long dark hair and engaging smile, she looks a little like Demi Moore in the 1997 movie G.I. Jane, before she shaved her head to join the Navy SEALs. The veteran unironically confesses that the MOVE party partly inspired her military career. "I sat there watching those towers fall just 20-some miles down the river, and being part of communities where we lost a lot of firefighters that day, as well as folks in the finance industry and other first responders, I had the feeling someone else got us into this mess and we're going to fix it. Of course, we did not. Terrible political leadership led into disastrous wars." Conley had a similar feeling in 2024 when Trump careened back into the White House and pretend centrist Lawler kept his seat. "Coming out in November to the country, I love be so divided and to feel that division is tearing apart communities and even families, that's what I'm most concerned about." Conley and her Hellcat sisters believe their military experience enables them to reach a wider swath of voters than many other Democrats do and offer solutions to partisan polarization. Data collected by the political group Vote Vets bears this out. Democratic military veterans perform 5.8% percentage points better on average than Democratic candidates who are non-veterans. Republican veterans, meanwhile, do not enjoy any advantage over their non-vet colleagues. Of course, for all their badass predecessors' political successes, it should be noted that they were not able to work bipartisan magic in Congress, at least not yet. Though their relative centrism probably helped several of them go on to statewide leadership, a much-needed contribution to shoring up Democracy Today. It's relevant that the badasses and the Hellcats came to service and leadership through the military, one of the most integrated institutions in American society, and the one most committed to giving its members the tools to climb economically from vocational training to college tuition to mortgage assistance, all of which helped create post-World War II middle class. As Trump shreds social programs and whatever safety net we have left, these female military veterans may be uniquely equipped to argue for the 21st century opportunity society and to be seen as credible by a bipartisan voter base that doesn't believe that our current political establishment is serious about addressing the political and economic decline of the past 50 years. There's undeniably a leg up the veterans have in their trust-building process. And yes, people honor their service, and that's all good and important, says Max Rose, a decorated Army veteran, former congressman, and senior advisor to Vote Vets, which cultivated a group of veterans opposed to the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan to run for office in 2006 and has been helping to build a cadre of Democratic veterans in Congress ever since. But their military service showed each of them that what the potential for America could be. You have this system and help people up, educate them, and foresee bonds across cultural, socioeconomic, and ethnic divides like none I've ever seen. It engenders incredible solidarity and ambition to overcome challenges, and that system is funded by taxpayer dollars. It has led to incredible leaders speaking to an incredible message across the country that we need. That's what the Hellcats bring. The Hellcats aren't carbon copies of the badasses. Elected the same year as the left-wing squad starring New York Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, 2018's female military veterans sometimes style themselves as moderate foils to these progressive women. After the Dems lost congressional seats in 2020, even as Biden won the White House, Spanberger blasted the left wing of her party. If we are classifying Tuesday as a success from a congressional standpoint, we will get fucking torn apart in 2022, Spanberger said. That's the reality. She went on, we need to not ever use the word socialist or socialism ever again. At the time, AOC fired back on cue. You can't just tell the black, brown, and youth organizers riding in to save us every election to be quiet or not have their reps champion then when they need us, as she tweeted. Or wonder why they don't show up for midterms when they're scolded for existing. ESP when they're delivering hit victories. In 2018, veterans did get slightly higher marks from conservative limited government groups like the Institute for Legislative Analysis, than the squad members did, but only after lowering the teens while the squad was in the single digits. In GovTrack.us's ideology tracker, the Democratic vets all fell within the more progressive 50% of the House's 435 members, while the squad was in the most progressive 10%. All were reliable votes on Biden priorities like the Build Back Better bill, which faced early opposition from conservative Democrats in the House, who ultimately supported it, and was torpedoed in the Senate by faux Democrats Joe Manchin and Kristen Sinema. On one issue, foreign intervention, Democrat vets may be more progressive than their non-vet counterparts. Rose tells me, I think veterans, and this is certainly the case with the Hellcats, are much more likely to want to use military force only when it's absolutely required, and to think about it responsibly. The Hellcats seem somewhat more ideologically diverse than their badass predecessors. So far, they haven't picked fights with their party's left. Much in the conversations with them, none mentioned New York City Mayor Zohran Mamdani, who ignored Spanberger's admonition never to mention socialism, to great effect, for better or worse. All four Hellcats are solidly working class, and they represent themselves in that way. Mendoza, the child of farmers, is a queer single mother who joined the army at 17 and whose family at times relied on SNAP and Medicaid when she was growing up. Conley's parents never went to college. Her mother worked for the U.S. Postal Service and raised three kids. Her father was a construction worker. And her grandfather and great-grandfather worked in the brickyards of Montrose, New York. Sullivan earned a scholarship to go to Northwestern University. While she was there, she's worked three jobs to pay for her room and board. Bennett went to college on an ROTC scholarship and worked two other jobs to get through. Their military background inoculates them against the questions about toughness that women candidates often face, a Democratic consultant points out. She didn't want to be quoted by name for fear of being seen as perpetrating the stereotype that women leaders are somehow weaker than men. Just because you've done the military doesn't mean you're actually a servant leader, says Emily Cherniak, a co-founder of New Politics, which recruits not just military veterans, but folks who have served in AmeriCorps, the Peace Corps, healthcare, education, and nonprofit roles. Cherniak is credited by the Hellcats with introducing the group's members to one another last year. In the service experience, they've learned how to lead teams that are diverse, Cherniak continues. They've had to bring people together towards a mission larger than themselves, and they've been really difficult situations, whether it's in Iraq, or whether it's in a school that's failing with no resources, or whether they're a first responder bringing relief in civilian conservation corps. My theory was that leadership experience is really necessary in political life. For a long time, the recruitment of House candidates was mainly the purview of local Democratic leaders alongside the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee. In 2006, the party took back the House, thanks in part to public revulsion over the Iraq War and Republican sex and ethical scandals. That year, Rahm Emanuel, the head of the DCCC, made a point of recruiting macho candidates like former college football star and social conservative Heath Shuler in North Carolina, retired Admiral Joe Sestak of Pennsylvania, and decorated Illinois-Iraq War veteran Tammy Duckworth, who's now a senator. That same year, Democratic Senate Campaign Committee Chair Chuck Schumer, now the Senate Minority Leader, endorsed the social conservative and former Marine Jim Webb, Ronald Reagan's Navy Secretary, to run for the Senate in Virginia. Vote Vets, also founded in 26, launched a major push to recruit veterans to Democratic politics, with the goal of wrestling the mantle of pro-national security away from the GOP. Prior to Vote Vets' existence, conservatives and Republicans were viewed as the pro-military, pro-security party for decades. The organization's website explains. Vote Vets helped change the dynamic. Now some of the best-known veteran elected officials in America are Democrats. That year, Vote Vets endorsed Minnesota's Tim Walz and Pennsylvania's Patrick Murphy, as well as Sestak and Duckworth. In 2018, it went all in for badasses. It aggressively backed Spanberger and Sherrill's runs for governor in 2025. Since then, the group has expanded into local and state races, and in 2024, 143 of its candidates won their bids for city, state, or congressional seats. Recruiting local candidates ensures there's a deep bench of veterans who can move up. Vote Vets has also moved beyond veterans' issues, becoming an active voice for gun safety legislation, the preservation of public lands, and labor rights. As the Trump administration slashed the federal workforce, of which 30% are military veterans, The group emerged as a savvy force pushing back against cuts. Vote Vets is currently endorsing 32 Democratic veterans, many of them incumbents, for Congress in 2026, including all four Hellcats. In the past decade, the party leadership's bias for middle-of-the-road candidates has spawned several more initiatives to recruit more progressives. Senator Bernie Sanders' insurgent 2016 presidential campaign inspired the formation of Justice Democrats, which helped recruit the 2018 candidates who would go on to form the Squad and others. The collective PAC, which recruits and endorses black candidates at every level of government through its Black Campaign School, emerges that year as since then it says it has helped elect more than 500 black leaders. Hillary Clinton's defeat by Trump spurred the creation of Run for Something, founded in 2017 to recruit progressive Democrats under the age of 40 to run at the local and state level. Run for Something reports that it either recruited or gave significant help to 1,500 young electeds. At the same time, Emily's List, which had been recruiting and developing candidates since its founding in 1985, stepped up its efforts to state legislatures and Congress after thousands of women contacted the group saying that Trump's election had inspired them to seek political office. Several Emily List endorsements have also been backed by Vote Vets. As we commiserated about the election over lunch in early 2017, Emily's List's then-president, Stephanie Shorrock, told me about badass Chrissy Houlihan, whom the group enthusiastically is supporting. Our next story from The Nation is headlined, Giving Black Youth a Reason to Live. Young people are facing an epidemic of mental illness. Here's how one community is rethinking the approach to the crisis. It's written by Danny McLean. When 21-year-old Marthion Trey Reed was found hanging from a tree on Mississippi State campus in September, the pained public outcry was immediate. The black and white image of a man was lynched yesterday flag with what the NAACP has displayed outside its national headquarters in the 1920s and 30s, filed my social media feeds. Rumors swirled online that the young black man had been found with broken limbs, proof there was no way he could have died by suicide, as official reports suggested. The thought of white supremacists lynching a student while the White House implemented its punishing policy of goals at the federal level was too much to stomach. I heeded the advice of a trusted Mississippi-based movement elder who urged her online community to avoid jumping to conclusions, wait for information, and join Reed's family in mourning the tragic loss of life. Having studied the mental health crisis among black youth for the past year, I've seen how the public will become more outraged by the possibility of foul play than by the possibility that a young person has found life too heavy a burden to bear and wants out. Whether or not the latter is what happened to Reed is a devastating trend. As of publication time, the results of an independent autopsy had not been released. Deaths by suicide are increasing for all young people, but at a faster rate for black children than young adults than for any other racial or ethnic group. Suicide is the second leading cause of death among black youth aged 15 to 24. Even elementary school-aged kids are flailing. Black children 12 and younger are twice as likely to die by suicide than their white peers. This phenomenon predates the first half of the decade, when the COVID pandemic increased isolation and race-based gaps in learning. A 2023 report found that from 2007 to 2020, the suicide rate among black youth between the ages of 10 and 17 increased by 144%. The person with the largest megaphone in the current debate on the emotional and mental health of American youth is Jonathan Haidt, a social psychologist at NYU Business School. His book, The Anxious Generation, How the Great Reviving of Childhood is Causing the Epidemic of Mental Illness, has become a guidebook for parents whose worry about social media and, by existence, cell phones have colonized their children's inner lives. But what I've gathered from conservatives with therapists, youth development workers, families, and scholars of black youth mental health is that hate's narrow focus on screen and a bygone era of outdoor play doesn't proportionately address what's happening in the lives of black adolescents. And it's not just hate. Articles appearing in mainstream news outlets tend to focus on the idea of a one-size-fits-all solution to the youth mental health crisis, ignoring broader cultural, political, and economic forces. Young people are experiencing traumatic events that rattle their psyches and alter the shape of their lives. What's worse, they too often feel that they have to navigate these forces alone, or that their perspectives are ignored when they do seek out help. There's been a lot of times growing up when I've been told what my needs are, Robbie Harris, a recent graduate of Ohio Central State University, told those of us gathered at a Black Youth Suicide Prevention Summit in Columbus last summer. Over months of reporting, I heard repeatedly from young people that the group's grown-ups who work with them, that they lack trusted adults, and safe spaces where they can create and feel a sense of belonging. I wanted to know what was happening in Cincinnati, where I am raising a black tween and where I know there are facing a mental health crisis that mirrors the rest of the country. The Cincinnati Children's Hospital Medical Center reported in 2023 that the number of children and adolescents presenting to our pediatric emergency service in mental health has doubled between 2011 and 2017. Cincinnati's population is about 50% white and 38% black, and that ballooning in admissions is driven in part by black children. The hospital's main emergency department sits just northeast of downtown Avondale, a neighborhood that's been solidly black since the mid-20th century and was an epicenter of civil rights and black power organizing and uprisings in the late 1960s. The natural data suggests gender, not race, is a risk factor. Black boys, 19 and younger, are more than twice as likely as black girls to die by suicide. That's not to say girls immune to the crisis. Between 2003 and 17, black girls' suicide rate increased nearly 7% each year, more than twice the increase for boys. And black youth who identify as queer, transgender, or gender nonconforming are among those who are suffering. According to a recent Trevor Project survey, half of the black LGBTQ plus youth have considered suicide and 20% had attempted it in the previous year. Being poor is another risk factor. A lot of the stressors have to do with the impact of poverty. We've got kids rolling in here who haven't had proper food, clothing, shelter, longtime educator and activist Howard Fuller told me by phone. Fuller is the founder of the Dr. Howard Fuller Collegiate Academy, a Milwaukee charter school that serves middle and high school students, most of whom are black. Those are really important stress points in their lives. To better understand what's happening in my city, I spoke with Tanisha Worthy, who was confounded and co-directs a Cincinnati youth development program called Youth at the Center. When I asked Worthy what's weighing on her mind and those of black adolescent students and young adults she works with, violence was her first response. They're concerned about losing access to their cell phones and, by extension, contact with parents and the outside world during the school day. In the fall of 2024, Cincinnati public schools, like many districts nationwide, began requiring students in grades 7 through 12 to lock their devices in a magnetic pouch while in school. Some students have raised concerns about not being able to access their phone during a school shooting or other emergency. Students are also worried about the prevalence of the vape pens and marijuana among their peers, Worthy said. One of the things that felt caused young people stress was my family, my mother, she continued, reflecting on the responses from participants in the worksheet she'd conducted in preceding months. A therapist who works local schools echoed this, citing family conflict, being saddled with adult responsibilities, and even estrangements from family as common among her adolescent clients. The other stressor was school, academic pressure, and needing a job. Improving family relationships or job opportunities is outside a young person's control, but the youth that Worthy works with are identifying what they need to feel better. Access to safe adults, therapists they can relate to, and third spaces, places to gather other than home or school, top their list. But instead of meeting those needs, Worthy says school mental health systems and other aspects of the city's infrastructure are contributing to the chronic hopelessness and feelings of being overwhelmed that are driving spikes in adolescent anxiety and depression. We are diagnosing it as the children and the problem. We're saying that parents aren't doing their part, but the longer we're not doing our job, she told me. What's needed is a genuine collective effort to give black youths a sense of joyful possibility. The day after the 2024 presidential election, I visited youth at Center for the first time. The organization is located just northeast of downtown Cincinnati in the Pendulum neighborhood, an unexpected place for a program whose teen clientele is largely black and working class. The area is filled with a 19th century Italianate architecture that has lured high-end development in recent decades. Average homes prices hover around $400,000 and have long been out of the reach for low-income black and Cincinnatians and their Appalachian counterparts who used to populate the area. On that early November evening, a dozen or so people from all over the city and northern Kentucky as well sat at tables eating pizza and chatting before the facilitated activities. I signed up in and put on a name tag. Sean Jeffers, the organization's other co-founder and co-director, took a break from the cheerily greeting arrivals by names and gave me a tour of the space, which is used to host and provide trainings for a range of programs, including a youth mental health initiative called HAY, short for Hopeful Empowered Youth, that develops strategies to improve mental health among young people in the community. White butcher paper from the previous gatherings hung from the walls in the main meeting room. At the top of one piece of paper was a prompt for young people to list the issues affecting their neighborhoods and communities. Beneath were answers they had generated. Just as Worthy had told me, one of them appeared repeatedly: shootings, violence, and gun violence. Twice the number of teens were shot in 2023 in Cincinnati than any other year in previous decade. In 2022, just over a fifth of the 64 people killed in shootings were children, and five of those victims were aged 9 or younger. The local number reflects a national phenomenon. A 2022 study of the American Journal of Preventive Medicine found that the black youth between the ages of 5 and 17 experienced the higher pre-pandemic levels of exposure and the largest increase in exposure to firearm violence during the pandemic. For these children, exposure to community violence can manifest as collective feelings of hopelessness, disorganized social networks, and altered social norms that can promote further violence, the research found. Sonali Rahan, an author at the study and a professor of health education at Columbia University's Teachers College, has argued that exposure to firearm violence should be categorized as an adverse childhood experience, a traumatic occurrence that disrupts a child's brain development that can change the trajectory of their life. The more ACEs a person experiences, the more likely they are to suffer a range of mental health problems. Providing resources such as grief counseling or other forms of therapy can mitigate the long-term harm. It's much more effective to increase right then and there, Rehan told me. This country has not invested in the resources to do that. Instead, when national figures weigh in on violence in Cincinnati, it's typically to criminalize black communities. A late-night fight in July was recorded and went viral on the right-wing account Libs of TikTok, where the blows sustained by a white man and a woman were highlighted and framed as evidence of black lawlessness. Other videos of events leading up to the melee capture the white men slapping a black man in his face and another white man shouting racial slurs into the crowd, where what's come to be known as the brawl became fodder for national Republican figures, including Vice President J.D. Vance, Ohio Senator Bernie Moreno, and Ohio gubernatorial hopeful Vivek Ramaswamy, to grandstand and to race bait. This does come as a surprise, given how Vance, an Ohio native and former senator, spent the campaign season stoking racial anxieties alongside President Donald Trump, making the false claim that Haitian immigrants in Springfield, Ohio, were eating pets. But when black people are victims or a state of vigilante violence, as opposed to the alleged perpetrators, these same figures are mum on distort the facts. In early May, police shot and killed 18-year-old Ryan Hinton as he and three friends fled on foot from the scene of a car chase. Days later, his father, Rodney Hinton, was accused of running a car into a Hamilton County sheriff's deputy who was directing traffic outside a commencement ceremony. Hinton, then 38, had earlier that day viewed police footage of his son's fatal shooting, during which the teen was shot multiple times as he fled from police. And just several months before Ryan's death, masked neo-Nazi had descended on Lincoln Heights, a historically significant black neighborhood, carrying guns and banners emblazoned with swastikas. The agitators hung a sign on an overpass in the community that read, "America for White Man," before being escorted away, but not arrested, by police. The next story is called Moms on the March. In the years after the pandemic, a right-wing movement against gender equality traveled from Puerto Rico to the United States. Its goal is to win over parents everywhere. This is written by L. Hardy. Last spring, the May Day USA tour, a traveling roadshow of Christian parents, rights activists, campaigning against gender and sexual expression in children, brought its message to five American cities. Each of its appearances in highly visible public areas such as Times Square in New York City and Discovery Green in Houston was something between a political rally, a Christian tent revival, and a college football tailgate party. Music pulsated from the sound system, hands were held aloft in praise, and speakers assured the crowd that they were a righteous silent majority, fed up and ready to roar. Invoking Jesus' love, activists, influencers, and charismatic pastors unleashed a barrage of alarmist rhetoric aiming to channel parental anxiety into a broader Christian supremacist project. The choreography was amped up and melodramatic, following a conventional arc, collective prayers, tearful testimonies, calls to protect children from unseen cultural forces. The point wasn't just to feel good, but to feel chosen, a persecuted vanguard with divine backing. By the end of each event, the crowd was buzzing, swapping Instagram handles and embraces, convinced they were simply attending a rally but standing on the front lines of a holy war. That is until the fourth of the five rallies brought May Day USA to Seattle, Cal Anderson Park. The choice of venue was not accidental. The park, named for Washington's first openly gay legislator, also sits in the heart of the city's historic LGBTQ plus district. By nightfall, the streets of Seattle were a battlefield, with fists flying and police dragging away 23 protesters. With the eruption came the prize every moment covets, national attention. Seattle's Democratic mayor, Bruce Harrell, condemned the violence, blaming anarchists for infiltrating the counter-protest. But his sharpness words were reserved for the May Day USA rally itself, accusing its organizers of trying to provoke a reaction in a city where values they reject. Seattle is proud of our reputation and a welcoming, inclusive city for LGBTQ plus communities, Harrell said. We stand with our trans neighbors when they face bigotry and injustice. That was the spark that turned the clash into a cause célèbre on that night. Deputy FBI Director Dan Bonigno, posted on X that his office would fully investigate allegations of targeted violence against what he termed the Seattle concert. Freedom of religion, he added, isn't a suggestion. The White House Faith Office, weighing in, condemning the violent disruption of the event and declaring it an issue of upholding the attendees' constitutional rights. For May Day USA's organizers, the national uproar was a gift from heaven. 3 days later, they staged a follow-up protest in front of Harrell's office. Dubbed the Rattle in Seattle, it drew 500 Christian and conservative demonstrators, protected by a heavy police presence and a fence around City Hall. One pastor in a MAGA hat led chants for the police and sneered, "If that makes me a fascist, sign me up." The Rattle's organizers were, other than to issue the Senate proclamation, a defiant missive to the city and to their detractors. His kingdom is coming, they vowed, proclaiming Christ's dominion over the church and the earth, and we, his people, will stand brave in this hour. For a movement hungry for oxygen, seemingly grassroots, a gathering of concerned parents made for the perfect launching pad. But that image masks the movement's real origin story, one far murkier and far more revealing than spectacle on display. In 2023, a secretive network of ultra-wealthy Christian donors known as Ziklag produced a strategy to return Donald Trump to the White House. It leaked a 9-minute video for members that comes across like the trailer for an apocalyptic film. A graphic repeatedly flashed with the central message being reclaim the Republic. Ziklag is named for the Old Testament town that was given to David by a Philistine king before hated Amalekites burned it and seized its people. David's daring defeat of the raiders and his rescue of the women and children was the victory that paved the way for Israel's throne. Today, Ziklag is an invitation-only club for ultra-wealthy Christian donors, including the Hobby Lobby's Green family, office supply titans the Ulithins, and Jockey Appeal's Waller family, among a membership that reportedly requires a net worth for in the tens of millions of dollars. It exists to pool money into projects aimed at reshaping American culture and politics, along with explicitly American culture and conserving Christian lines, even claiming that credit for the Army Coney Barrett's appointment, we should say Amy Coney Barrett's appointment to the Supreme Court. Ziklag was founded after Trump's 2016 election by a Silicon Valley entrepreneur, Ken Eldred, who, in a lead-up to Trump's first electoral victory, backed an important meeting between American evangelist leaders and Trump through a faith-based nonprofit called United in Purpose. Eldred had amassed his substantial personal wealth through a mail-order computer access business in the 1970s and 80s, and then merged it into a software giant in the 1990s, before becoming deeply entrenched in conservative politics, including serving on the Finance Committee for George W. Bush's 2000 presidential campaign. In the private sphere, he promotes what he calls Kingston in entrepreneurship, encouraging Christian business people to bring Christ into the workplace and spread the gospel by starting for-profit businesses. He believes that Christians must operate on a triple bottom line, as he calls it, where economic, social, and spiritual capital are pursued in tandem. But after Trump's election in 2016, Eldred's political passions were reignited. He warned that wealthy Christian people to come together, according to a longtime collaborator. The COVID pandemic, he said, was a gift from God, bringing us about his advancing kingdom through a series of glorious victories, cleverly disguised as disasters, and ensuring that people return to the Christian faith. That mission of Ziklag is no less ambitious, to remake American politics in the service of an oligarch class convinced of its divine right to rule. That secret video from its December 2023 Trailblazers Cultural Engagement Summit opens with a booming declaration: "We are boldly pursuing the reclamation of America's founding as a Christian nation." The presentation lays out a plan to target battleground states where we need to refocus on values-based voting, distilled into three political or strategic pillars. The first, checkmate, would bankroll election integrity. The second, steeplechase, would mobilize faith leaders and congregations. And the final one, watchtower, would procure a culture war or parental rights and opposition to sexual and gender expression. For watchtower and steeplechase, Ziklag's power hampered Jenny Donnelly, the wife of telegenic preacher in Portland, Oregon, a mother of five and a former multi-level marketer, and its public face. We know little about how she managed from relative obscurity to become a leading figure in evangelical circles, other than that she and her husband Robert launched the Collective Church and Telestiae Ministries, which oversees her voice MVMT as its political arm. A cut-and-paste Christian mom, Donnelly has initially tried to make a name for herself with at-home workout videos. Her sudden elevation as the leader of the Christian social movement followed a script that's familiar in right-wing circles. The pandemic lockdowns, especially church closures, galvanized Donnelly and many around her, while the Black Lives Matter protests in Portland's 2020 Summer of Rage pushed them fully into action. Initially, her voice, MVMT, had no significant following. It was another slick one-click checkout site, pushing faith-based courses on living and righteous life, a dime a dozen in the evangelical charismatic world. Ziklag's intervention changed that. In the Trailblazers video, Ziklag outlined its blueprint to turn parents' rights to crusade into a full-blown political machine, promising to create a coalition of like-minded groups, amplify their efforts, and bankroll them to wage a culture war more effectively. The wedge issue, it insisted, was government control over our kids, with parents supposedly forced to remain silent while the transgender lobby attempts to take over. At the central part of this crusade would be her voice, MVMT, which Ziklag promised would build 300,000 prayer hubs nationwide by the end of 2024. The prayer groups were designed to be weaponized as frontline organizations, drilled with training materials from Charlie Kirk's Turning Point USA, Fire and Brimstone Pastors, and the America First policy stores. The plan was to rebrand conspiracy theory-soaked paranoia as grassroots moral revival, and to hardwire its directly into electoral politics. As promised, Donnelly exploded onto the national stage at the end of 2023 with a call for simultaneous prayer rallies in every state capital in April of 2024, followed by a million-woman Christian nationalist march on the National Mall that October, weeks before the general election. The May Day USA tour emerged from a partnership between Her Voice and Ross Johnston Ministries. Johnston, affiliated with conservative organizations, is a millennial preacher with the energy of a Twitch streamer and a conversion story tailor-made for his audience. Born via artificial insemination and raised in Los Angeles by two lesbian mothers, Johnston says he grew up with an orphan spirit, loved but unmoored, floating through life and searching for a destiny. In his telling, the COVID lockdown and the loss of in-person contact drew him to the church and in the process helped him overcome a 9-year porn addiction. Like Donnelly, Johnston experienced the pandemic as a turning point for a revival of religious liberty. Yet Donnelly offers something more. As a relatable face for a prioritized political demographic, she embodies the both tradition, renewal, political sermons that blend kitchen table wisdom with apocalyptic urgency of the charismatic revival, a guarantee of family and faith fronting the uncompromising political campaign. Many in Ziklag's inner circle, including the pastors who elevated her, hail from the neo-charismatic Pentecostal movement and its more extreme edge, the New Apostolic Reformation. With an emphasis on the Holy Spirit and its role as the conduit for personal relationship with God, its strain of evangelism that has surged through global Christianity in recent decades. It's the religious current running beneath MAGA, led by figures like Trump's spiritual advisor, Paul Whitecane, and defined by the physical intensity of the faith, the laying on of hands for healing, ecstatic worship, and daily battles with demonic forces. The shutdown struck at the core of the neo-Christian spiritual and economic models. Without the exuberant intimacy of the worship, they couldn't face practice their faith as they understood, nor could it sustain the ministry circuits and event-based revenues that underpin their institutions. For those like the Donnelly family, pastors with real skin in the game, the threat was spiritual, theological, financial, and existential. But with Donnelly's movement may look like an all-American sawdust tent revival, its playbook comes not from the likes of Phyllis Schlafly or Sarah Palin. It comes from Peru. In 2016, Christian Bosian, the son of a prominent Peruvian evangelical congressman, a graduate of Jerry Falwell's Liberty University, and an advisor to the perennial hand-right presidential candidate Keiko Fujimori, emerged as the face of Con Miss Hijo, No Te Metas, which means don't mess with my kids, a slick media-savvy campaign claiming that gender education in schools was homosexualing children. That's a quote. Several years of poor performance by Peruvian scholastic children in international tests had pushed education to the forefront of national debate at the time that liberal sexual and gender reforms to the national curriculum were taking place. For conservatives, the two issues fused into a single flashpoint, bringing together a coalition of faith-based groups that were mobilizing against a succession of so-called progressive presidents elected between 2011 and 2020. Under the banner of Con Mis Hijos, No Te Metas, the coalition framed economic reforms as a threat to children and forged powerful alliances between evangelical and Catholic churches and symmetric politicians. Those that initially lost to key court battles, the moment succeeded in maintaining a rigid definition of gender in policy debates, galvanizing popular opposition to women's and LGBTQ rights. Education Minister Jaime Sandoval, who was the first spearheading the liberal reforms, championed social tolerance and said he wanted our boys to internalize gender equality. But in late 2016, Peru's Congress, then controlled by Fujimori's right-wing Fuerza political party, ousted him on dubious corruption charges, a move widely seen as punishment for imperiling Fujimori-aligned business interests through his reforms of higher education. Donnelly frequently points to this moment as an example of the political power her movement could wield in the United States. In March 2017, CMHNTM staged its first national rally, which, according to Rosas, took place simultaneously at all 25 of Peru's regions. It was a vivid example that church could unite despite the doctrinal differences. Rosa says, proud of the movement's ability to bring evangelicals and Catholics together at a time when they're in strong competition for followers. By doing so, we were able to bluntly break the law, he said. Rosa claimed that 2 million people turned out. Opponents put the figure at 68,000. The reasons for what followed are contested, but soon after, the education ministry made concessions to the curriculum. A year later, President Pedro Pablo Kuczynski was ousted on corruption charges. Unlike Salvador's removal, his fall had broader issues and causes, but the conservative panic over his administration's gender agenda left him politically weakened and more vulnerable to attacks from the right. Rallies continued as Kuczynski's former vice president, Martin Vizcarra, took office, with the arch-conservative Fujimori and Fuerza Popular intensifying their fight against gender and sexual education reform in Congress. After losing both the Supreme Court challenge and the 2019 congressional elections, the pro-retest movement returned to the streets during the pandemic, seizing on discord and chaos and ultimately helping to unseat Vizcarra on corruption charges. Peruvian politics rarely captures global attention, but then George Soros, an American anarchist figure to many of political right, took a personal interest in the bitterly contested battle. Last year, Soros' Open Society Foundations announced the completion of global restructuring, according to Rosa, which would curtail its philanthropy in Peru. The decision, which the nation could not independently confirm, was credited with the right-wing circles to the influence of CMHNTM, with many hailing Rosas as the man who drove Soros out of Peru. The claim supercharged Rosas' profile among hard-right Christian networks abroad, where activists saw Peru as a model worth exporting. His movement quickly caught the attention of people within the money, conviction, and ability to make its concerns a central issue in American life. Rosa instructed his new admirers in the United States that are particular the tricks to the success of the movement. Its first is structural. It is no hierarchy and does not exist formally, making it immune to tax audits and NGO regulations. We are a ghost, he says. The second is strategic. There are no formal rules beyond working with the branding and the guidelines, which include focusing on ideology rather than individuals and using their secular wording so that neoconservatives and non-Christians, especially athletes and celebrities, feel comfortably aligning with the cause. Harking back to his American education, Rosa leveraged the traditional networkers like televangelists, exporting his formula across the region. His slogan and strategy traveled well. In Brazil, it felt like Jair Bolsonaro's cultural war in politics. In Argentina, it dovetailed with the rhetoric that would help propel Javier Milei to power. And in the United States, it appeared to Zigzag's architects, who saw the potential for a bigger and more moneyed stage. Experts believe the brokered the alliance between Rosas and Donnelly, who describes copy-pasting his playbook. What he said to us on Zoom, she explains to her followers, that is where you're headed, America, and you have to have an opportunity right now to stop it before it gets worse. Calling her new movement Don't Mess With Our Kids, or DMWOK, and even using the same stark blue and pink colors that Rosas believed were fundamental to his campaign's every appeal, Donnelly hit the road. He held rallies for the suburban mama bears in a swing state America. With her active role in Christian rights campaign for Trump's re-election, Donnelly's transformation was complete. The woman who had spent years trying to spearhead Christian moments with little success was now pictured front and center in a group of prominent evangelical leaders lying heads in Trump 2 weeks before his re-election. For Americans used to exporting ideas abroad, a movement imported from a small southern neighbor may sound unusual, but it speaks to a much deeper trend. For centuries, missionaries from Europe and North America fanned it across Latin America, Asia, and Africa to spread the gospel and civilize locals. Today, the traffic's going the other way. And this has been our reading of the magazine The Nation for Tuesday, the 17th of February. My name is Al, and have been reading on the Talking Information Center.